I never know whether to applaud at the end of worship either. But I know it was not as half-hearted as it appeared, at least there. Yeah, it's good to be back. I know that we had CR Sunday last week, and I did listen to that on the way. And I did listen to that on the way home from the airport. Some of you might not know that I was gone even during that stretch. I know you missed me terribly and probably pine away to nothing when I'm not here. But it had an excellent trip. It was long and involved, like it always is. But we did meet with Global Empowerment. Actually, there were three mission organizations gathered around the table all at the same time, and we were talking about the possibility of getting involved with a tribal group on the northern side of the island of Mindoro, south of Manila, south of the island of Luzon. And it looks, at this point, that we've made the decision that we'll do that, get involved with them, and find out what that looks like. And it could mean, the possibility is there, big dream-wise, it could mean actually, as an end result, reaching another 7 unreached people groups, if God paves the way for that as we get involved. So perhaps I'm trusting that you'll be praying about that. Does my heart good? It is intimidating as well. And speaking of missions, you've seen this thing circulating, I guess, and it's been up on the screen a few times. We had a meeting. I met with the elders. I'm not one of the elders, so you know that. I actually have the privilege of working for them as I work with them. And we're well aware. Jason said, what was it that you said due to something else that had developed or something else that had happened? I hope you know that Camdenton won its game. The Camdenton Laker football team won their game on Friday night, and that means... What that means is that they actually have gone into the postseason, and the first postseason game happens to be this Friday night, which means that that a curveball, I'm not even suggesting who threw the curveball, but a curveball was thrown to the elders, and it's not beyond them to be able to hit a curve, and that's what they did. They thought of you first, and you know, just so we're clear, we did not have any images of this church being full of people who wish that they were at the game. Really, quite the opposite would have been the we didn't want you being there and having any kind of, oh my goodness, I wonder if I should be at church. And you know, we moved Friday night into Saturday, and what that means is that all the effort that went into planning has changed into effort that's going to be made to reorganize. And so what I'm asking in response to that is that you will respond to that effort by making an even more concerted effort to be here on Saturday. I sound like my father. But that you'll make an even more concerted effort to be here on Saturday. There are plans on Saturday to be exposed to areas in the world that we don't know anything about. As we mentioned, one of the missionary families that will be here are working in a creative access country, in a place where they are not supposed to be preaching the gospel. They'll be telling us about that. We won't be recording those messages because we don't want those out on the podcast, and it would not be safe for them if we did. And so we're hoping that you'll come. There'll also be some active activities. There'll be worship. There'll be food. I mean, you know, come for the food, stay for the missions conference is really what we're hoping that you'll do. In that light, instead of it being 9 to 2, it'll be 9 to 4 on Saturday. Rather than asking you to come back Saturday night, you have in your bulletin, your folder, an RSVP. The reason we're asking you to RSVP, respondez s'il vous plaît, is because we want to know if you're going to be eating food that day. So if you're planning to be here and to eat, it'd be great if we knew how many were going to do that. If you show up without having RSVP'd, we will send the RSV police out after you. No, we won't. We won't turn your name in anywhere, but it's going to be an awesome weekend, including next Sunday, which starts at what time? 9 a.m., an hour earlier than before. And it occurs to me that if I don't get to this message, that I will not get done. And I don't know, maybe I should just keep you here till Saturday morning as we try to make our way through the next The next message, the next series. We're on a series in the book of Hebrews entitled So Much Better Than. This morning we're going to be looking at part 29, A Better Value, which comes from Hebrews 11, verses 23 to 31. It is our 29th week in the book of Hebrews. That's hard to imagine. I know that we didn't do Hebrews last week, but 2 weeks ago we met over in our 28th session and looked at another part of Hebrews chapter 11. We'll come to that in a moment. But as we've made our way through the book of Hebrews, we're trying to learn, and we spent a lot of time on foundational stuff, you know, trying to sort out exactly what it was that the author of Hebrews is saying to us. There was an awful lot that he told us so that he could tell us the things that he's telling us now. And so I hope that you were able to be here for most of where we've been in the book of Hebrews so far, and that provided a foundation for you to make the statements that we're going to make this morning and next week, and or not next week, but the week after, and on in through the rest of the year as we pursue the book of Hebrews. There is a theme verse. Oh, see, I keep forgetting that's there. At some point, when I do remember it and you have your cell phones, you may want to take a picture of that. Simply better. That's really what's driving the book of Hebrews. We're not the only church that's ever studied Hebrews. We're not the only ones that have ever taken this approach to the book of Hebrews. That there's something better for us today than we had previously, than what the Old Testament saints had. Men like Abraham and Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and their wives and families. They had so much less than we have today, but somehow managed to do what seems to be so much more than we tend to do with our faith. And I don't mean that in a purgative way at all. Simply better than. The author has this is the theme verse, and you notice that it's Hebrews 13. We still aren't there. It's going to take us some more time to get to that point, but the high priest, he says, carries the blood of the animals into the most holy place as a sin offering. The bodies are burned outside the camp. Jesus also suffered outside the city gate to make the people holy through his own blood. Let us then go to him outside the camp, bearing the disgrace that he bore. Because we don't have a city here that's continuing. Even the great city of Camdenton will not last forever. And so we're forced to seek something that is beyond the city of Camdenton and what's being offered to us in our locality here. The author of Hebrews is a Jew, we've said, and who's believed in Jesus. He's writing to his fellow Jews to encourage them to leave Judaism and become Jews who believe in Jesus. But he's also writing to us. He's writing to us wherever we are on our journey and however far we've come in our faith. He's writing us to tell us that there's more. There's always more. Until the very day that you die, there will be new opportunities to trust God and to receive the blessings that come, the blessings and benefits that come from trusting God and making that decision. And so as he writes to these Jews, he's also writing to us, whatever situation you find yourself in this morning, there is more. However much blessing or benefit is flowing into your life today, there is more. And we're learning from Hebrews chapter 11 that all of it comes to us by faith. That's what Hebrews chapter 11 is telling us. Last time in Hebrews, 2 weeks ago, we looked a little deeper into the lives of Abraham and Sarah. And we admitted going into it, prior to that, when we looked at the life of Abraham and Sarah and his call and the way that he seems to fumble around an awful lot early on in in the life of faith. He was the first of those who stepped out from where he was to believe God to go somewhere else, to become something else. God made promises to him. He believed God. He took him at his word and stepped through into that. But 3 weeks ago when we looked at that part of Abraham's life, we were all wondering, how did that guy get here? I mean, his obedience was incomplete and he didn't really nail it in terms of, you know, if it was a gymnastic routine, it was like a 3. And we looked at Abraham and we said, how on earth did he get into this hall, faith's hall of fame, this museum, as it was, of pieces of what God has done in the lives of people. 2 weeks ago, when we looked at the sacrifice of Isaac, we began to realize that Abraham really has more place there in faith's hall of fame Well, then certainly I do. I won't speak for you. I'll speak only for me. But the thing that God asked Abraham to do in the sacrifice of Isaac required more faith than has been required by anything that he's ever asked me to do. And I don't want to misappropriate that and diss my wife at all in any way. And so she's taught me amazing things about trusting God. Well, we moved in among headhunters back in the early 80s in 1980. We moved in among headhunters with two little children, and she went in there just absolutely trusting God. She's talked about it with her friends, and here at the hospital, and some of them have actually said to her, "You moved into a tribal group with a 2-year-old little girl and a 6-week-old. Did you do that on a bet? What was motivating that? How on earth did you ever reach that decision?" So I don't want to say that she hasn't trusted God or that we haven't trusted God with things. But this thing that God asked Abraham to do was far greater, far more weighty than anything he has ever asked me to do. Required more faith than I have ever shown. But Abraham, as he goes into that situation where he's ready to sacrifice his son, and no, God is not asking you this morning to sacrifice your son, so don't be worried about that. That's not how he moves. And in fact, God wasn't asking for Isaac. He was testing Abraham to see what Abraham was willing to do as a response in his faith. And Abraham didn't sit back and say, "God, I'm willing to do anything." He actually went and obeyed. And that's the amazing thing about that story. But Abraham's faith was not blind. We talk sometimes about blind faith. But blind faith is a kind of faith that expects God to do something that he has not directly promised. Did you track with that 2 weeks ago? Blind faith is expecting God to do something that he has not directly promised to do. And some of us wander through life like that. We want to believe God, and so we there's pressure on us to believe God. There's pressure on us to expect God to do the miraculous in our lives, and well, it doesn't always turn out well. Recently in the news, and I want to be as gentle as I can as I talk about this, but recently in the news there was a story of a 9-year-old girl, perhaps you heard it, had a tumor growing in her chest, and the tumor expanded to the point where it compressed her heart and stopped her heart. They rushed her to the hospital, but it was too late. By the time they got there, they ended up putting her on life support machines, and her life was not supportable at that point, and she passed away. According to all of the tests of medical science, she passed away. And so the hospital came to the parents and said, "We think it's time to take away the life support. We don't believe your daughter is actually here anymore." And the family, the mom and dad, along with some people that were gathered around them, they refused. "We're not going to take her off life support." And so I don't know if you heard the interview later, but somebody who appeared to be the pastor of their church was there with them, and I have been there with families at that moment when that decision is being made. I'm not pretending that it's an easy decision to make. But they decided that they were going to sue the hospital to keep their daughter on those life support machines while they had time to find another facility that would put her back, that would keep her on life support. And when they asked them why that was, it looked like the pastor of their church responded, "We want to give God time to do the miracle we know he's going to do." That was the answer. And I'm not in a place right now. I don't mean to push that issue and to tell you that they made the wrong decision. I'm not saying that at all. I'm only saying that we go through life. We have a tendency to go through life blindly. Blind faith is when we expect God to do something that he has not specifically promised to do. And I know we're all dealing with something this morning. It may be that this past week you were given a diagnosis that was the last diagnosis that you wanted to hear. Doctors sometimes sit down with their patients and say, "It's cancer, it's metastasized, it's moving through your body. I can't come up with a good treatment plan." It's not that he's giving up, but he doesn't expect that it's going to make that much difference. Please hear me. I'm going to say it as carefully as I can. If you've received a diagnosis like that, then for goodness sake, for the sake of your own heart and your family, ask God to reverse it. Believe that he can reverse it. There's no question about that. But what God can do and what God will do may not be the same thing. And that's what part of what Abraham taught us as we look at this blind faith thing. He taught us how faith actually works, that there is a difference between what God can do and what God will do. Believe that God can do it. Nothing is impossible for him. And continue to ask. The book of James tells us that sometimes we don't have the things that we want because we don't ask for them. And so go into his presence and acknowledge that you know that he can. And believe him for that. But understand that there's a difference between what he can do and what he will do. And Abraham taught us that principle. Abraham went into the thing with Isaac. He wasn't blind. His faith was not blind. To understand how this thing, this sacrifice with Isaac went, there were some things that Abraham knew going into it. Isaac was the son of the promise. Isaac is the first of millions of descendants. And if Isaac dies without having a child, God's promise falls flat on its face. God told Abraham that he would have millions of descendants. And right after, not long after he told him that, after he made that promise and fulfilled it in Isaac, years passed, but now suddenly God is asking Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. Abraham knows that Isaac is the son of the promise and that millions of descendants are going to come from him. But at the moment when Abraham is preparing to sacrifice Isaac, Isaac had not had a child. Isaac had no child. Abraham is ready to sacrifice Isaac, but Isaac had not yet had a child. And so Abraham knows, not in the process of blind faith, not in the process of what God can do, Abraham knows what God will do because of the promise that God made to him. God said specifically, you'll have millions of descendants that come from Isaac. Isaac has not yet had a child. Are you catching I almost called it a disconnect. It's the connection that Abraham made. Isaac hasn't had a child. Millions of descendants are coming from him. So Abraham knows that no matter how this goes down, whatever happens, Isaac has to be alive at the end of the story, even if it requires God to raise him from the dead. Romans 4 tells us that. Hebrews 11 says the same thing, that he actually received him back from the death because he knew that his son had not had a child. He's not being blind in his faith. He's taking God at his word and resting on that promise. God had been very specific about Isaac. He knew that God could raise Isaac from the dead. He also knew that God would raise Isaac from the dead because God's promises are wrapped around that. No one, hear me loud and clear, no one will ever be able to stand in God's presence throughout all of eternity and catch his attention and say, you made a promise that you did not keep. That will not happen, because God always keeps his promises, and we can rest on that. So Abraham knew the difference between what God can do and what God will do. Abraham believed God can raise the dead, but he also believed that God would raise the dead because there were specific promises related to Isaac. And so if you've had that diagnosis, come and talk to me. I don't want to take your hope away, but I do want you to recognize that while God can heal, he still is the sovereign of this universe and is making decisions about your life and mine that are better than the ones that we would make for ourselves, no matter what it is that we want. So don't let me take your hope away by any stretch of the imagination. God can heal. He can answer that prayer. He can do that thing that you're asking him to do. But like the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do you remember they said, we know our God can do this, but even if he does not, we will not bow down. We will not accept another master other than him, even if he doesn't do what we want him to do. That's how deep their trust had gone. We spent 2 weeks, the 2 weeks prior to this, working through the life of Abraham, and we actually, over the last few weeks, since we started chapter 11, I don't know if you're aware of it, but we've worked our way through the book of Genesis. We've talked about Abel, we've talked about Enoch, we've talked about Noah, we've talked about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and that really takes us to the very end of the book of Genesis. Well, the author's not done, and so he's gonna step out of that. It's time, actually, now to step into the book of Exodus and meet a man. Well, the man that plays the starring role, if there is such a thing, is Moses there in the book of Exodus. The author of Hebrews is going to talk to us about two times in his life. He spent a lot of time on the call of Abraham. He's not going to say anything about the call of Moses, the way God first interacted with him. He's going to talk about an incident that happened right after he was born when his parents exercised faith. And then he's going to tell us about an incident that happened later where Moses himself exercised faith. It's going to be another one of those generational things. And well, we'll talk about that as we go this morning. There's this thing that happened when he was born and this thing that happened later on that showed his faith both happen in the same chapter of the book of Exodus. And so I can tell one story running into the other because, well, that's the way the book of Exodus is laid out. So be listening for how Moses' parents exercised faith. And be listening for how Moses himself exercised faith. And with that background, this is the story from God's word from Exodus chapter 2. A man from the tribe of Levi named Amram, and a woman who was also from the tribe of Levi named Jochebed got married. That's a great way to start any story, isn't it? I mean, a little bit of romance going on there. Amram and Jochebed. I don't think we have a couple here named Amram and Jochebed. We wouldn't know what to do with Amram and Jochebed if they were here today. But Amram and Jochebed, with all the romance that we can muster, got married. The problem was they were married during a time when, well, they were both from the tribe of Levi, which means they're from the tribe of Israel, from the nation of Israel. But Israel during that time was in slavery in Egypt. And so Amram and Jochebed, while there was all this romance going on, and they decided to get married, and not too long after they were married, they had a daughter, and well, not long after that, they had a son. We're not sure what they named this young man because he doesn't get his name from his mom and dad. That comes into the story later. They had a son, and they happened to have this son at a time when the Pharaoh of all Egypt had begun to completely mistrust anybody that was from Israel. In fact, he gave instructions, important, awful, terrible instructions, that anyone who was from Egypt that ran across any child, any boy child who was from the nation of Israel, that child was to be thrown in the river by order of the king, by order of the Pharaoh of all of Egypt. That was the rule. And so Amram and Jochebed decided, and Jochebed most primarily as his mother decided that she would just hide the boy away. She kept the boy in hiding until he was somewhere around 3 months old or so, and then she realized if you've got a three-month-old in your house, you realize how difficult it is to keep a three-month-old hidden when people are wandering around looking for male children. And so she decided that she would take a really remarkable step. She took a basket, a papyrus basket, and got some black pitch and spread the black pitch on the inside of the basket and the outside of the basket. And in order to keep her son safe, she laid him down inside that basket when it had dried and laid the basket in the bulrushes, the weeds down by the shallow part of the river. As I mentioned, this young boy had an older sister, and so she asked the older sister, the mom asked the older sister, her name was Miriam, to just kind of hide out and watch the basket there in the bulrushes. She didn't want anything to happen to Moses, even though she had no idea what was about to happen. It happened on that morning that baby, that young baby boy was laying there in that basket in the bulrushes. There was a cover over the top of it to keep the sun from getting at him. It happened that the daughter of the Pharaoh of all Egypt went down by the river to bathe, to go swimming. She was there with some of her servants and some of her friends, and well, she happened to notice as they were walking along the river, she happened to notice that there's a what is that basket floating in the water over there? And so she sent one of her servant girls to go and get the basket, to retrieve the basket out of the water. She pulled the basket out of the water and they brought it over to her, and she opened it up, and lo and behold, well, you know what was in there, but she didn't. Lo and behold, there was a baby boy in there. She knew immediately that it was one of the Hebrew children. And, well, God arranged this, I suppose, but that little boy is just crying his heart out. And as Pharaoh's daughter looked at that tiny baby boy, so afraid and so hungry and so alone, there was an instinct that kicked in her heart that made her want to take care of this little child. And that was the moment when Miriam came running up and said to Pharaoh's daughter that she was aware of the "Do you want me to go and get somebody?" she said. I could take the baby to one of the Hebrew mothers, and they, you know, they could take care of this baby and then, you know, bring them back, the baby back to you when it's time. And so the daughter of Pharaoh said, "Go and have her take care of it, and I will pay her for her services." How remarkable. And the next thing we know, Miriam is arriving back at home with the baby in arms to give him back to Jochebed, his mother, so that she can take care of him in anticipation of the day when he would go and live in Pharaoh's household with Pharaoh's daughter. Time went by, and it's probably 2 or 3 years, we're not really sure. But she brought this baby back to Pharaoh's daughter, Jochebed did, and gave her to Pharaoh's daughter, and Moses began to grow up. She named him Moses because Moses sounds like the Egyptian word for drawn out of water. And so that's what she called him. This is where I got this kid, that's what I'm going to name him. Moses grew up there in the household of Pharaoh's daughter, and as he was growing, he never lost sight of who he actually was. So the day came when he decided that he would go down and visit in the midst of all of the opulence, in the midst of all of the wealth and the power that was implied by being the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He decided that he wanted to go down and see his people. He knew that he was Hebrew. He never lost sight of that. He went back one day to see his people, and while he was there, he noticed how difficult their life was. And in fact, there was an Egyptian slave master that was beating a Hebrew slave. Moses stood there and looked from side to side to see if anybody was noticing, and he intervened. He went in and grabbed hold of the slave master, and well, we're not exactly sure how he dispatched him, but it ended up with that slave master dead. Moses took his body and buried it in the sand and just kind of wandered off hoping against hope that nobody had seen or noticed. The next day he went back, and while he was back there, he saw two of the Hebrews arguing with one another and actually fighting, and so he went after them. He said, you guys are both slaves. Why are you hurting one another? Don't you have enough to deal with without doing that? And well, one of them spoke back to him and said, well, who made you the judge over us? Who put you in charge over us? Are you going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian slave master yesterday? It took Moses' breath away when he heard that, and he assumed, well, that this thing is known. And he wasn't sure what was going to happen when Pharaoh heard about it, but when Pharaoh did hear about it, he tried to kill Moses. He put out a kill order, and so Moses escaped from Egypt and went as far as he could to the land of Midian, and well, he'll be back to Egypt at some point, and you probably have already anticipated that part of the story. But for right now, that is the story from God's Word. Moses was a man who understood. He grew up there in the household of Pharaoh, Pharaoh's daughter. You may have anticipated it already, but the author of Hebrews is going to say, listen, that Moses' parents were living by faith when they protected the infant Moses from being killed, that they were doing that by faith. The author of Hebrews is also going to say that Moses was living by faith when he ran from Pharaoh and headed towards Midian. It's not a terribly brave thing to do, but he was living by faith as he did that. We're going to unpack both of those truths before we're done this morning, but it's time right now to read the passage together. So if you would stand with me, we're going to read Hebrews chapter 11, verses 23 to 31. Would you read it aloud with me? By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the application of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. God blesses us when we read his word. Thank you. You can take your seats. We were visiting a family some time ago who had a son. He wasn't too old, but they were convinced that their son was really quite bright, bordering on genius, to hear them tell it. And the reason that they thought that their son was so bright is that he would lay for the longest time, they said, I'm not sure that it was hours, but he would lay for the longest time staring up at the fan up above his head as it spun around. He would just lay there and be really preoccupied by that fan turning, and they were convinced, and trying to convince us, that this was evidence that this child was a genius. And so, you know, I thought to myself, I wondered how they would react if I, instead of carrying on in conversation, if I were to lay on the floor and just stare up at the fan as it spun around. I didn't have the courage to actually try that, because I thought maybe they'd have me sent away to some hospital or something. You know, one of those jackets that fits so much better than any jacket. But parents do that. They all have a different way of testing it. I love it when we're visiting with somebody, and that's, you know, he's really bright because, and I love what comes out next. Everybody that I've ever talked to believes that their child, well, is smarter than the average bear, right? Just smart. This child, he's going to be something someday. I've never actually heard a parent say, my kid is dumber than a rock. They just don't do that. You know, that's not, and if you're feeling that way, I don't, you know, come and talk to me later. I would love to hear your story and why you believe that. But most parents believe that their kid outshines other kids, and that there's something out there for them that they're going to be able to do. By the way, it's true, but the measurements is what I'm talking about. Moses really was different. We're not sure what it was about him that made it clear to his parents that he was different, that there was something special about him. But he was born during a time when Israel was living in captivity in Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt. And the faithful people, the people who truly believed God, knew that they couldn't end their history there. They knew that a day was coming when they would leave Egypt and go back to Canaan, because Egypt was not the land that God had promised to them. He had promised them the land of Canaan, and that they would live there, that they would own that land. They would have that land someday, that land northeast of where they were in Egypt. The faithful remembered that specific promise. They knew that they would someday live in Canaan. And so the faithful were constantly asking God to keep that specific promise that he had made. They knew that they couldn't remain in Egypt, because they would be able to say to God, you didn't keep your promise, and no one is ever going to be able to say that. So they prayed that God would send a deliverer, someone to save them from their slavery in Egypt and lead them to the promised land. And then one day Moses was born. God had answered their prayers. And Amram and Jochebed, Moses' parents, saw Moses as God's specific answer. God's specific answer. And that's why they took the step that they did. Instead of listening to the king's command, she made that basket and lined it with pitch, and of all things, put that basket in the water with her young child in it. And not knowing exactly what God was going to do, they believed that God would intervene. Listen to me. They didn't want him to be wealthy. They didn't want their child to be wealthy or famous or comfortable. They wanted their child to grow up, please hear me, they wanted their child to grow up to live out the dream that God had for him. They believed that God had a dream for their child. And that's why they were willing to take the risk that they took. By faith, they moved, believing that God had a plan for their child. They believed that God would use their son, and God responded by honoring their faith. I know that many of you have children, and you probably have, or you should have thought through what it is that your dream, your goal for them actually is. Have you thought that through, those of you that have kids? Has it occurred to you to sit back and wonder what this child is going to be? What's the destiny of this child? How do I provide direction for that as they head off in that direction? But I wonder how many of us have the faith and courage to say that our only concern for our child is that he grow up or she grow up and live out God's dream for my child. That's really all that matters to me. I wonder how many of us, and I'm not looking at anybody as I say it, I wonder how many of us have had the courage to say that. What I want for my child is that my child would grow up and live out the dream that God has for my child. God, I'm not asking for wealth or fortune or fame. I'm not even asking for health. I'm only asking that you would make your dream for my child become a reality. God has a specific dream. I remember the day back in 1979. I know most of you weren't, a lot of you weren't even alive back then. But I remember the day back in 1979 when I said goodbye to my mom for the last time before we went to the Philippines. My dad had died just a couple of years before that, 3 years before that, and so I really was leaving her alone. I was the last of the children at home. My other two brothers were married already, as was I, but now it's time for us to go and do the thing that we believe God has asked us to do. My mother, that morning, we got up and she made breakfast like she so often did, and some of her coffee that would dissolve a spoon as you stirred it down into it. I mean, she knew how to make coffee. And we were all done with that meal. It was time. I cleared my throat and stood up, and we had known for a long time that this moment was coming. My mom walked me over to the door and threw her arms around me and pulled me into a hug. She was only 5'3", so there wasn't a lot of her, but you know, she raised three boys, three firstborns. I don't know how she managed that. But she locked me in this hug and buried her face just right there and wept like I hadn't seen her weep since my dad had died. She held on for the longest time. And then finally she pushed me away at arm's length and looked me right in the eye. And she said, you know, before you were born, and I know this was true because of stories she told me all during my childhood. Before you were born, she said, I gave you back to God. Soon as I knew that a child was in my womb, I gave you back to God. And I told God, literally, I told God that he could take you and use you in any dark corner of this planet that he chose. And she said, I promised him that when the time came, I would let you go. But, she said, through the tears, I never promised him that I wouldn't cry. I pulled her back in, and another last long hug, and we were gone for 5 years. She had a sense of that she passed on to me from the time I was very young, that God had a dream for my life. That there was something he meant for me to do, specifically for me to do. Something that he had that he was going to use me to do. Her approach to me and to life was very like the approach that Moses' parents took. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw that he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. His parents were not concerned about his comfort or his safety. They were concerned that he grow up to live out the dream that God had dreamed for him. And they were willing to take risks, if you want to call it that, to see that become a reality. Because they believed that God had a dream for their child. They wanted him to grow up into that dream. Now, it's one thing for parents to hold that goal, that their children will grow up, but sooner or later their children grow up. And the question is, have they been successful in passing that along? Have they said to Moses, have they helped Moses to understand? Now, we know that Moses only lived in their household for about 3 years until he was weaned and ready to go to live with Pharaoh's daughter. But in that short time, they were able to instill in him a sense of who he was and a sense of God's purposes for his life. Look at verses 24 and 25. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. You know, we spend a lot of time in the 21st century worrying about what our kids are going to get into. Has it occurred to you to be concerned about that? If it hasn't, wake up. This world is full of things that can draw your children away and ruin their lives in a heartbeat. It should occur to us to be concerned about that. But stop and think for a moment that Moses grew up as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He grew up in a place where things were available to him that weren't. He grew up with more danger and more sin open to him than your children or mine have ever had to face. But Moses understood that the pleasures of sin are fleeting. He knew that he could get involved in that. He knew that he could give his life to that. But he knew that it would waste away quickly. The pleasures come and the pleasures are gone. Listen to me. I've heard pastors say that sin is no fun. Boy, the people who say that sin is no fun, they're not doing it right. That's all I know. Sin is fun. That's why we do it. That's why we make that poor choice. But Moses understood that moving in that direction and giving his life to that would draw him away from the things that God intended to use him for. We sometimes will follow in that, and we take those pleasures and we take them for granted. And by the time we're done, the angst has come back, and I need the pleasure again. The angst and the pleasure and that cycle draws me into what we would call addiction. Because that's what addiction is. Addiction is not going to show up there on the screen. Pleasure without satisfaction is addiction. Pleasure without satisfaction. And just like, you know, our time at CR last week, when we talked about issues that we have in our lives, and yes, I'm aware of the time, when we talked about issues that we have in our lives and things that draw us away, let's just play with this for a moment. What if I were to offer you, think about that thing that draws you away, okay? That thing that keeps you from being all that you could be for God's glory. I'm not asking you to shout it out. We're not going to do that. But I think about it. And let me ask you, all right? Let me ask you. If I were to offer you $1,000 a day not to do that, would that be an interesting offer for you? $1,000 a day to say no to that thing that's pulling you away. But here's how this is going to work, okay? I'm going to put it in a trust fund for you, $1,000 a day. And every day that you say no to that sin, I'm going to add another $1,000 for the rest of 365. So there's going to be a $365,000. Anybody interested in a $365,000 trust fund? All you have to do is say no to whatever that thing is. But here's the deal. If you say yes to it during that time, you lose all of it. You know what I'd like to suggest? I would like to suggest that that's a pretty respectable reward. And that if you had that thing in your, if you could just, whatever it is, if you could, I imagine that there are many of us here that would find a way because of the respectable reward. Find a way to say no. The same thing was true of Moses. Moses said no to the pleasures of sin. Why? Because he hated sin? Because it wasn't fun? Because it didn't feel good? No. He said no to the pleasures of sin because he was looking forward to the reward that God would give him. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the application of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. Moses was careful about his life. He understood that God had a dream for him, a place to use him. And he was willing to say no to things that were pulling him away because he had respect for the reward that would come to him someday. That's true across God's word. We look at the people of faith. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. Listen, what I'm trying to say to you today is that when we begin the life of faith, there will be any number of things that keep us, that pull us, that draw us away, that show themselves to be attractive. There's going to be any number of things that you need to say no to so that you can say yes to the dream that God has given you. Yes to the dream that God has given your children. And if you learn to live like that, then you can pass that on to your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. This woman Rahab, the prostitute Rahab, I don't know if you know her story. But Rahab is going to marry a man named Salmon. They're going to have a son named Boaz. And Boaz is going to marry a woman named Ruth. And Ruth is going to get married. And they're going to have a son named Obed. And Obed is going to get married. And they're going to have a son named Jesse. And Jesse is going to get married. And he's going to have a son named David, the king of Israel. Rahab, by faith, became the great-grandmother of King David. And by faith, became the beginning of a line that would end in the coming of Jesus Christ to planet Earth. The Messiah descended from her. What's God's dream for you today? What's his dream for your kids? What are you willing to say no to today to pursue that dream? Are you willing to say yes to that dream? If it's not about comfort and wealth and health and prosperity, are you willing to say yes to that dream for the sake of realizing that God has a plan for you, for your children, for your grandchildren, for your great-grandchildren? You could start a heritage that would turn your family upside down. What does that make you want to do? Would you stand with me in the presence? Father and our God, scattered again, but we've come to you with hearts that are open to what your plan for us is. God, we're going to go into the missions conference this weekend, and we're going to hear stories about the way you've worked in the lives of these missionaries and the way that you've worked in the lives of the people that they've ministered to. And God, I pray that you would grab hold of our hearts and help us to realize that we have the privilege of turning the world upside down. The miracle, God, is not that I would become wealthy or famous. The miracle is that you could take a mess like me and make my life matter. And the same thing is true of everyone here. And so, God, we're going to lay that before you. We're going to ask you to move in our hearts and move in our midst and help us to grab the dream. For the sake of your glory, for the sake of the good of those people that you've planned for us to reach, we ask these things. In the name of the Lord Jesus, amen and amen. We've met together. We've huddled up. We're going to head out there. The play this week, by the way, the play this week involves meeting again next Saturday morning and next Sunday morning around the theme of missions. So with that, I'm just going to say, ready? Go get him, Potter's House.